Hey, this is Johnny with a bit of an admin note. As you are probably aware, there's been a lull in the podcast. That is a result of me deciding to close the business. So there will be more on that at the end of the podcast, but I wanted to at least get out this last one. And then at the end, I have some questions on soliciting feedback for maybe a pivot for keeping the podcast, even if I'm shutting the Kneeboard business down. But as a bit of an intro, this interview is with Rick Harper. He's the founder of Harper Aviation. How we're related is a little bit confusing. He married my dad's cousin, which I think makes us second cousins. But sometimes, just since there's an age difference, I refer to him as my uncle, and that kind of sets our relationship a little easier. Sorry for the poor quality. I think one of us was having connectivity issues, but the episode is well worth it. He talks about navigating the airlines during COVID and being able to draw lessons back from when he was an airline pilot during 9/11. So still lots of lessons to learn here and well worth the listen. Thanks. Welcome to the Ultimate Aviators Podcast, where we pair a unique guest with an interesting question to help us master our craft and demystify the industry. I'm your host, Johnny Henderson, owner and operator of Harper Aviation, home of the Ultimate Kneeboard. Let's get started. Okay, Rick Harper, welcome. Excited to have you on. Founder of Harper Aviation, and it's stayed in the family. So,
yes.
Be fun to go into some of your background, talk about how you got it started, and then ultimately we'll get to the question of what an airline union rep does for the pilots that fly for them. So, why don't you start with a little bit of background on your career in aviation.
Well, like most people, you've got to have a start somewhere, and there's got to be some spark that gets the fire going. And for me, that was when I think I was about 12 years old. A family friend, as far as our family Christmas present, it was to go for a ride of, I think, Cessna 172 on Christmas Day in the Bay Area. And so we took off out of the Palo Alto Airport, flip over the peninsula, out of the Golden Gate Bridge, and back. It was just a gorgeous, crystal clear day in the San Francisco Bay Area. And that was what kind of really sparked my interest there. And so in high school, I had a part-time job. I saved up my money. After high school, I went to the College of San Mateo. They had a really good aircraft program. And so I took all the ground school through College of San Mateo. And then I went down to the local airport, San Carlos Airport, and paid for my flight instruction. And my flights were in a Piper Tomahawk. And back then, as far as getting your private license, spin training was part of the syllabus. And so we actually did spins in the Piper Tomahawk, which has been nicknamed the Trauma Hawk, because it didn't last very long. And then later the FAA removed that as far as the training for a private pilot's license. I got my license right after my 19th birthday and knew I loved it. And then kept adding up some hours while I was in college. And I was in the ROTC program. Brigham Young University, and then there administratively there were some issues not getting my paperwork done in time before the board, so I actually took my paperwork at the local recruiter and got my pilot slot. I went through the officer training school, and then from there pilot training at Reese Air Force Base up in Lubbock, Texas, and I graduated the top portion of my class. They kept me on as an instructor pilot. I had what was called a fighter pilot qualification, meaning you could accept an aircraft commander assignment right out of pilot training. So single seat fighter or coming back in as an instructor pilot. So went down to Randolph Air Force Base in San Antonio, Texas, and went through instructor training there, back up to Reese Air Force Base, and I was there for 3 years as an instructor. And the timing was such that I came up for my follow-on assignment in April of 1991, just as the first Gulf War was coming to an end, and then the drawdown in the military forces were beginning. So the career options just were really limited at the time. And so I had to make a tough decision. Do I accept the E-3 AWACS to Prince Sultan Air Base in Saudi Arabia and on 6 month assignments at a time, as my oldest daughter is just coming up on 2 years old, or do I say, you know what, I need to be able to be more of a father, and we'll have to look for plan B and join the Guard or Reserve. And so 6 weeks after I turned down my assignment, May 1 of 1991, the early release program came out in June of 91. I put in for that. By the time the paperwork went through, I got out active duty middle of October and moved back to Idaho, where my wife was from, and eventually rejoined the Idaho Air Guard, flying C-130s for them. And then I retired from the Air Guard in February 2015 after 28 combined years of service between active duty, small time in the Air Force Reserves, and then Air National Guard. And of course, as you know, being in the Army National Guard, you bounce on and off of active duty orders, and same thing. In the post 9/11 environment in C-130s, we were very busy. So I had a number of shorter deployments and longer deployments. And I think at one stretch, I was off military leave from my airline job for about 18 months. So anyway, did that up until 2009. And then I finished up in a staff position as the Inspector General for the Idaho Air National Guard. And that was a really eye-opening experience, as basically complaints resolution. So fraud, waste, and abuse, reprisal, restrictions, abuse of authority, type issues is what I dealt with. And that was, I think, a great foundation for eventually becoming a union rep at their night job. So anyway, that's kind of it in a nutshell there. But to just go back to when I left active duty, the economy went into a recession after the first Gulf War. Mm-hmm. Airlines weren't hiring late 91, and airlines started furloughing. And I think it was 92 timeframe there also. And so there were little to no hiring going on. And so I was actually flight instructing right there in Boise and using my military shoot knee board, and couldn't believe we couldn't find something on the civilian market that was similar to it. So one thing led to another, did a little more research, and I had 20 boards of makeup from me, from my neighbor that had a really good sewing machine. Sold those to my students, and then had a local a bigger sewing shop that did industrial stuff, did another batch of like, I think 50 or so. And I sent a few of those off to the different flying magazine, you know, AOPA, Flight Training Magazine, Plane and Pilot, and to do the new pilot products review section in the magazine. And I'll tell you what, that was something else, that free advertising. And that really kind of took off like crazy. And then getting individual calls for individual orders like crazy. And then Marv Golden was the first dealer that had the contact to me, wanted to start stocking it. Marv Golden out of San Diego, California. And so he's still a customer of ours here. And of course, that was back in, I guess, really 1993 when we got the company up and running, because I was flight instructing in 92, and it took a while to get things going. Yeah. And get to production. So huge learning curve when you're literally, you know, building a business out of your garage and do all the assembly and shipping and stuff too. So it was a great learning experience. And of course, it kept getting bigger than I could handle. And it was a good way for the kids to all help in and have a little job at home to pitch in for that too. And then of course, the kids are all out of the house. And so it's like, this is more than my wife and I can handle too. So thank goodness you came along. You said, hey, here's a win-win situation here. So there you go.
Yeah. Now my kids are the laborers.
There you go. And that's great. They can earn their own money and spend their own money at the store and stuff too. So that's good. And the neat thing too, I just love what you've done with the website and everything too. And of course, your generation is a lot more tech savvy, social media savvy, hence the podcast, because you know, that was never a thing back in 1993 when I got this started. So anyway, it's really been a neat ride seeing how many dealers, you know, and customers, not just in the United States, but also internationally too, that have reached out to me too. So it's been neat. So
do you remember what month in 93 you started it? Because I was born in February of 93. So I was wondering if I'm older than the company or the company beat me.
I'd have to go back and look at the paperwork, but I believe it was the spring of 93.
Okay. Yeah, so
I think so, somewhere there.
I'm 32. So I mean, Harper Aviation's been around 32 years.
Yeah.
You know, a couple months off of me.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
pretty crazy.
Yeah. And, you know, the knee board was the loose ring model with seven rings. And people kept saying, hey, kind of a great idea, but it's kind of a pain to have to undo the seven rings. I go, yeah, I get it. So I had to shop around and finally find the seven rings to have the binder style, the fixed ring. And so
for, you know, Jeppesen charts?
For the Jeppesen chart to fit that. Mm-hmm. And so that's what we did for quite a while. And then, of course, the demand came up for being able to use an iPad also and attach that to the knee board as well, too. And, you know, the size of the iPad has changed over time. So the iPad Mini really seems to be the good fit for general aviation airplanes, for it to fit in the D-board stuff too. So again, listen to customers, taking the feedback, and going from there. Not just the individual customers, but also your dealers as well too.
Yeah. Well, to kind of set up questions along the way that I wanted to revisit. So was it through the Idaho Guard that you started flying C-130s? Because you had the option to go fighters out of Reese, but then instructed in your trainer, right? And then when you joined the Guard, they sent you to the C-130 qual? Or did you show up to Idaho already in your... The Army, we say your go-to-war aircraft, like a Black Hawk, is not what you learn to fly on.
Yeah, so when you go to assignment night in the Air Force there, you know, basically that was the draw. And of course you serve at the Air Force. And so then it was basically, hey, we want you to stay here as a T-37 instructor. So that's where, at the time they told you pretty much are handpicked to come back as an instructor based on your flying skills and your personality also. So again, my timing was poor as far as getting to go fly an F-15 or F-16 because the military drawdown was starting in April 91 after the first Gulf War. And so just the way I was there too. And then with the Idaho Guard, they actually, when I got on with them in 96, they had a squadron, were just transitioning from the F-4Gs, stand up a squadron of A-10s and C-130s. And by this time, I'd already been flying with Horizon Air for a little over 3 years and had about 2,000 hours of a Metroliner, SA-227, which is the equivalent of a military 26. And they said, you know, hey, we've got a few openings for the A-10. The A-10s aren't going to be around long. We've got four C-130s coming. We're going to plus up to eight. You know, you've got all this turboprop time and instructor time. You know, there's more career opportunities in the C-130. So, once you know, so I said, great, I'll go to the C-130 and see the world. And our C-130s got caught up in the BRAC, as they called it, base realignment of 2005, and eventually the C-130s went away. I think it was April 1 of 2009, and in exchange for losing to the C-130s, they plus up a few more A-10s. I was already a lieutenant colonel at the time, so rank wise, I was too old rank wise to transition over. The most of the majors and below at least interviewed and applied for the A-10s, and some of them picked up the fly up, and some are still flying it too. So like I said, I got the staff job, being the inspector general, did that for 6 years and loved that. It was an eye-opening experience.
Yeah. Yeah. So then you started flying for the airlines. How did your timing work out to go from, I forget who you said you started with, but you ended up with a major airline. Right now, there's a huge desire for military pilots to get to the airlines, but usually they have to start with a regional. So is that the path that you followed as well? Or because you were already flying turboprop planes, that gave you maybe a smoother transition than someone with just their commercial?
Well, again, so I got out late 91. From active duty, the economy was going into recession back then. The airlines had stopped hiring, then they started furloughing also. And there's furloughs for a while too. So rather than chase a regional job back east, you know, I was applying for jobs and stuff too, to stay out west and living there in Boise, to pass the time, I was flight instructing out of Boise and doing quite well and keeping very busy doing that too. And then eventually I got on with Horizon Air in the spring of 93. Flew there out of Boise for 3 years, went to Reno Air in 96, and that was also the same time I got picked up by the Idaho Air Guard as well, too. So that was a very, very big time frame in there, learning the MD-80 for Reno Air and also the Idaho Air Guard, too. It was just go, go, go.
Gotcha.
Yeah. So I got picked by Reno Air a couple months before getting picked up with the Guard, and then I had to wait for my training slot to go to Little Rock, Arkansas, which is where all C-130 training is done for the Air Force.
Okay, gotcha. So then you end up transitioning to a major airline, and you did double duty in the Guard and a major for a while there. And then I was at your retirement where your daughter got to MC, and then you fully switched over to just airline pilot. I remember for a long time you stayed as a senior first officer, so you got your choice in schedules, and then it wasn't until you finished your military service that you switched over to pursuing captain, right?
Yes, that is correct. And that's the thing too, at the major, they've got so many different categories of airplanes, from, you know, your small narrow bodies to the medium narrow bodies and wide bodies, that I was flying the co-pilot in a wide body aircraft, and I got very senior in that category too. And that's a really good deal, because just pretty much write your own schedule, and then all I had to do is pick up one overtime trip a month, and I was basically making captain's pay out of it. But I still had a great schedule. So I've always put quality ahead of the size of the paycheck, because you know, you only get one crack at being a father for your kids. And with four kids in the house, and you know, all the different, you know, baseball games, soccer games, softball,
Ski
lacrosse,
team.
ski team, and choir concerts and marching band and all that stuff too. You know, it's just a lot to juggle. And but it's easier to juggle when you've got you know, good control over your flying schedule too. So yes, I did put off upgrading to captain for quite a while, but I really don't think I sacrificed any pay, because like I said, I was able to pick up some overtime flying here and there, and that more than made up for the difference stuff too.
What other airframes did you fly? So I remember one conversation. I'm not an airline guy, so my familiarity is a little short, but I remember you switched to the double decker just to have the experience of flying that before it went away. What all have you flown for the airlines?
So Horizon Air, like I mentioned earlier, the SA-227, Swearinger Metroliner, and that's the military equivalent of a C-26, so two-engine turboprop, 19 passengers. Of all the planes that I have flown throughout my career, civilian and military and airline, that by far was the hardest plane to fly well. The planes were bent, cable controls, no hydraulic assist, and it was no autopilot either. You had to fly that airplane. And so it was really a challenge to fly it well.
Did you
And
know
then
the Colorado Guard is still flying the C-26?
I did not know that. Yeah, that's something else. Yeah.
We have a C-26 unit.
Yeah, Idaho Air Guard, when I got on with them, actually had one. A lot of the Air Force Guard and Reserve units had them, at least Guard units did, as a support aircraft, especially when you had a fighter airplane that breaks down. That way you could load up maintenance personnel and equipment in the plane and go out there and get the planes fixed. But I also know when we had them, they had the avionics were a lot more advanced than what we had at Horizon Air back then too. So anyway, so yeah, I went from there to Ringo Air. They had MD-82, 83s, 87, and they were just getting some of the MD while I was there. And like I said, just there for 2 years. And then I got hired at Delta in February of 98. And then in December of 98, that's when American Airlines bought out Delta. And a lot of people ask me, do you wish you would have stuck around and gone to American? It's like, no, I came from the front door at Delta. I was able to get my first base right out of the gate, which was Salt Lake City. And I started off sitting sideways as a 727 flight engineer, and then upgraded to co-pilot on the 727. And I did that in, I think it was June 2001. And then, of course, that only lasted for a few months. Then 9/11 hit, and Delta then decided to speed up the retirements of the 727. It was 727s were configured for 150 passengers at the time, and the replacement airplane was the 737-800s, the new generation 737s. And so they were speeding up delivery, taking as quick a delivery as they could of those while they were getting rid of 727. So I actually got bumped over into the 737-800, and that was a really nice plane, you know, especially when you're flying airplanes that are a week off the assembly line and have that new airplane smell. That was a fun plane to fly, and a lot of good city pairs. And then about a year later, I transitioned down to the 737-300, the analog avionics, and those are the plane that Delta acquired with the merger with Western Airlines back in 1986. And that was actually some really nice flying, because the range was very limited. So you stayed on the high 1-2 chart, which so means you barely went east of the Mississippi. And so one time zone change either direction from mountain time in Salt Lake City. And you did a lot of Montana flying too, which is really nice back then too. And then Delta, like I said, 727, the 737, 800, 300. Then went on military leave for a while, got activated. Came back as Delta was in bankruptcy, and then came back to the MD-80, MD-90 category. And of course, I'd flown those at Reno Air. did that for a couple of years, went to the 757, 767 category, and initially that's the domestic category, then it devolved into an international category. And then in 2015, I had the small window of opportunity by the 747s after the fence came down from the merger with Northwest. There was a 5-year fence. And so anyway, that finally came down, and I'm like, you know what, I don't pass up that opportunity. So got to go fly it, and I got a total of 9 landings and just under 300 hours on the 747, 400, until they decided to, again, go back and retire a few more. And then I went back to fly the 757 and 767. So I stayed on that for, let's see, when was that? Till 2018, I think it was. And then I was part of the initial cadre, if you will, bid for the Airbus 220, which was the known as the Bombardier C series, until Airbus bought it out and renumbered it the Airbus 220. But it's really a CRJ on steroids with everything. Side stick was really nice, and super nice improved flight management too. And so that was fly that for about 3 years. Then I had an opportunity to go back and fly the 757 as a captain, and did that. And just last fall, I checked out on the Airbus 350. So my first time flying a legitimate Airbus, and the Airbus 350 is, you know, also an Airbus on steroids, all the bells and whistles. And even folks that have flown the Airbus, you know, 320, 330, like, yeah, they're still way different here a little bit then. So anyhow, that's been quite the learning curve, because just the design philosophy and the terminology between Airbus and Boeing is very different. So out of my 27 and a half years at Delta, you know, 22 have been on a Boeing. So anyway, so still getting there.
Yeah. Well, it's cool that you're still, pursuing goals on the latter half of your career. I mean, just the number of aircraft you rattled off, and we were talking earlier that you just passed 18,000 flight hours, which, I mean, I can't imagine, right? I'm at 500, but 18,000 is quite a feat. So,
yeah, it's a fair amount there. But like you were texting earlier, you said you hit 500 hours, and I can remember when I hit 500 hours. I was so excited. That's a great milestone. And you know, you'll be 1,000 before you know it too. So anyhow, you got a lot of great years ahead of you. So anyhow, that's super.
Well, I had another question that I think you'd be maybe uniquely positioned to answer, because we've talked about it before, but could you elaborate on the partnership between the commercial airlines and the DoD? I remember we had talked when I was in flight school maybe about how the DoD relies on being able to employ the commercial airlines for a lot of logistics in times of military need.
Yeah, sure. There's a command of the military known as the Transportation Command, and it handles, again, transporting things by air, land, and sea. And when there's more need or more demand for transporting personnel or cargo from air, the military has current assets. They actually reach out to the airlines to help out, both the cargo airline, passenger airlines. And then on top of that, and so that's day in and day out they do that. And there also is a clause for their Civil Reserve Air Fleet that, depending on the nature of the situation, can get activated so that the airlines have already agreed ahead of time to be able to offer up a certain amount of planes for dedicated military use should the need arise, which, of course, we saw in after 9/11 and later on the second Gulf War too. So that's been keeping people busy with all the stuff we were doing in Iraq and Afghanistan also. Delta, you know, had a lot of, and all the other airlines had plenty of Silver Reserve Air Fleet flying going on for a while too.
Yeah, that's interesting, because I think actually the way it came up was when airlines go into bankruptcy, why it's important for national security to ensure that the capability sticks around. And it was, I think, the Civil Reserve clause that we were discussing.
Yeah. And I've got a PDF copy. I think I mentioned that to you earlier, too. It's under the Reagan administration. They identified the airlines as a strategic military asset for that reason, too. Because, again, we don't ever want to get to the situation, because we have so much of a global presence militarily, to where you ever have to rely on a foreign carrier that is owned and or operated with a country that doesn't really see eye to eye with us politically. And that, of course, becomes a force protection issue, both in terms of, you know, cargo or even military personnel. So that's something you want to control of.
Yeah. Oh, that makes sense. Cool. Well, here, I'll throw you a question that'll get us on board with our thesis here of union rep. But what does a day in the life of a union rep do? What's their primary role, and what's the mix of training versus advocacy versus just the negotiation or even just education?
Yeah. Being part of a union is a different animal than, you know, when it's in the military, because, you know, under the military, you're under the Uniform Code of Military Justice. And for the guard personnel, you're under your respective state's code of military justice. And then it's a little different with being an airline that's represented by a union and collective bargaining organization there, too, because, you know, you've got a contract every few years, and day in and day out, you know, you're required to follow your collective bargaining agreement, and so is the company. And for the most part, everything's, you know, fine and well. There's always times where folks don't understand that they've, you know, crossed a line there and done something incorrectly according to the contract. And part of that is, you know, ignorance, especially, you know, under with a new pilot, not understanding that. And then similarly, there are times where the company misinterprets part of the contract, and that's where disagreements come about. And you try to get those resolved at the lowest level as you can, best as possible. But the primary job of an elected union rep is to, one, protect a pilot's job. In other words, if there's going to be any discipline taken against a pilot, you want to ensure that due process has been met, and that the company has dotted their I's, crossed their T's, and they actually have a sound foundation before they move forward with any type of disciplinary action too. And when I say discipline, anything from, you know, there's letters of counseling, letters of warning, suspensions for, you know, 15 days up to 60 days, something like that, and then all the way up to termination also. And I've got to tell you, that's the worst part of being a union rep, is having to sit next to a pilot when they're given the option of signing paperwork for termination or signing paperwork for voluntary resignation. And, you know, either one is just like, geez. You know, you look at the hoops you jump through, I jump through. Everyone, you know, start out in the flying business, you know, you're putting in a lot of sweat equity, blood, sweat, tears, if you will, and you need to get your rating, your flight time, and to get to that major airline job. And it is so bad to see folks put their job and their career in jeopardy because of something. So you're trying to do what you can to really tamp things down and keep any discipline to an absolute minimum there too. Unfortunately, like you've seen in the news, there are some things where, you know, pilots get themselves in trouble with the law, and that really can do and rep on that too. They gotta get a good attorney for that kind of stuff. So
Brad,
our big thing is you know, like I said, protecting their job in accordance with the contract. So protect the pilot's job, enforce the current contract, negotiate the next contract, and then promote the profession is the primary core thing that elected rep is supposed to do. But it's a 24/7 job, and so it ebbs and flows. My phone was blasting like crazy, you know, once everything hit back in 2020 with COVID, and, you know, the flying pretty much come to a stop, and, you know, all the air were threatening furloughs. And thank goodness we got the CARES Act came through there too. We had some furlough protection in there for all the air that accepted the furlough or the CARES Act money. And so that bought some time too. But when it was over back in the fall of 2020, then, you know, pretty much all the airlines were able to mitigate or keep the furloughs to absolute minimum. So that was a trying time, especially with the really justified. It's calling me, not knowing what's happening, what's going on, what do I need to do, and do I need to get another job, et cetera, et cetera. You know, so that was a challenging time, and, you know, especially folks like, hey, we just bought a house, got a pregnant spouse, you know, knowing about health insurance and stuff too. So fortunately, we were able to come to a win-win situation, and not have furlough any pilots. Delta was great. I was happy to be part of that and negotiate that with a letter of agreement, and keep everything the property, the paid status, and obviously provide the company with the opportunity to get the pilots back and run up and back online in minimal time also. Because most of the airlines have once you get furloughed, you've got a certain number of years for recall rights where you can bypass the recall and you feel it's safe to come back, I guess, if you will. And previously, after the 9/11, there were a number of pilots that had the opportunity not just to do things differently civilian, but also militarily, go back on active duty, regular duty, or active duty guard or reserve unit. And those folks out the full 10 years before they came back. And so anyway, it provides some flexibility. So by coming to a win scenario in November 2020, we were able to keep a lot more pilots a paid status. And like I said, that provided the opportunity that the company to get them back up to speed, qualify in minimum.
Nice. Well, I think that's important too, because not just attrition, but the other half of that retention, you can't replace experience on a moment's notice. So being able to hang on to the people that have experience and be flexible enough to find a amicable solution, even if it's not the best for either party, the economy ebbs and flows, and to not say goodbye to people that have a lot of the necessary credentials, but maybe the situation's not there. I mean, we're seeing it a lot in the military right now, is as the airlines become a lucrative option for people to transition, how do we replace the people, especially now, that went to the global war on terror and had deployment experience, and now we're flush with people who have never deployed, or maybe have only done more peacekeeping deployments, as opposed to, like, I am an air assault helicopter pilot and I've worked with a ground force customer in a combat environment. That experience is leaving, and so we've had to get creative in training opportunities and to really work within those constraints creatively. So it makes sense that the airlines can do the same thing. As a union rep, I assume that you're representing the pilots. There's also a flight attendants union. Are there any others that you work with, or what does it look like to work with them for a combined solution?
Well, at, again, in my career, Delta, and I don't speak for them. I'm just saying, and the only other union is the group at Delta, the dispatcher. That's so it's pilots and then the dispatchers, and they're the ones that we work with as far as our plan.
Gotcha. Okay.
Yeah. I just want to go back to, you know, one of the things you're saying as far as the retention of the military. So one of the things I do, I get a lot of feedback from our, you know, military guys too. And one of the things that really drives a lot of the folks, and of course it ebbs and flows, but off of active duty, the operational tempo. And not just the operational tempo from active duty, but operational tempo with how much guys in the Guard Reserve are getting used to. And that's where, again, how much of an economic versus the quality of life with just the deployment and et cetera, too. Because it's like, okay, yeah, they are from these bonus money and everything, but it's like, I'm constantly deployed. I'm not there for my wife and kids or spouse and kids, significant other, whatever. And you're gone. And for me, the longest I was ever, you know, deployed, four separate deployments, the longest was, I think, 70 days. So a little different with C-130s, because when we swap out crews, we swap out airplanes also at the same time. And of course, the stand over there in, you know, Iraq and Afghanistan beats the crap out of the turbine. So we'd suck the planes back also. A lot more bearable than our counterparts are on the ground. They're going there for a year plus on their deployments too. So
for sure.
Yeah. But that's the biggest thing is the quality of life issues. You know, we're beating them up. I mean, they love some of the flying, but it's just, and that's just where, you know, the military is getting stretched too thin. And let me just circle back a little bit too, to 1991. So again, the drawdown started after that first Gulf War. And, you know, again, I got an assignment that I really didn't want. I was looking forward to go fly an F-16, was my dream airplane, you know, F-16, something like that, something but the, you know, moves fast and, you know, all that. And it just, at the time, it wasn't there. And I remember after I went to the colonel to turn down my assignment officially and sign that. And I ended up getting grounded immediately from flying. And talked with my operations officer in the squadron. And he had served the tail end of Vietnam. And he goes, the Air Force, they're going to do the same damn thing that they did after Vietnam. They're going to start cutting people. They're going to cut two men. And the folks that know that go make it outside the military are going to go. And we're going to be the ones that are scared to leave. And you just watch. Give it a few years, and they're going to start recalling people back to active duty. And that's exactly what the Air Force started doing, too. They cut too far, and it went back and forth. So that pendulum's always swinging, is what I'm saying, not just in the military, but then also in the private sector also. Because the pendulum's always swinging, it's ebb and flowing. So that's always the challenge for any industry, is to get your staffing just right. And, of course, like I said, we saw we had no idea with COVID how long that was going to last, uncharted territory. But, obviously the flying down big time there. And, who knew when those could go, you ever thought, so you're hearing from the experts, let's do this to flatten the curve, and then that things should die down in the summer months because the virus didn't do well, et cetera. And, that, of course, lingered on, and kept getting variants and stuff too. So, obviously, uncharted territory for a lot of folks there too, and not knowing. But once the vaccines came out and got rolling there, boy, the recovery came super, super fast. A lot of pent up demand for flying. A lot of pent up demand. And that was the challenge too, because, with the airlines that have several categories, you froze up. Still there?
I think we're good. Is your microphone covered though? It's been a little choppy.
Oh. Hey, hopefully it's not. I don't know where the microphone on this MacBook. I don't plug it in. So,
Well, I think we're good then.
Yeah, so what I'm starting to say is, some of the airlines that have one airplane type, like Southwest has 737, Frontier, Spirit have Airbuses, et cetera, it's not as big a deal as far as the training costs, because when you have to go backwards, well, you're taking a current qualified captain to putting them in the right seat, and then they furlough and you bring them back, then it's a short course to get somebody transitioned from right seat to left seat if they're already type rated in the airplane stuff too. So at the bigger carriers, we got several categories. Not only do you then, it's a cascading effect. So you go from, having to furlough from bottom seniority wise, and then everyone kind of ratchets back down. So you're basically having to train people off of, an airboat, wide body airplane down to narrow body airplane from a captain back to the right seat, not necessarily in the same airplane, might be a different airframe too. So the training costs are huge going backwards. And then it's also big going back the other direction too. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the things where we were able to work good and make the business case back in the summer of 2020 and fall of 2020 to say, hey, let's see what we can do here to keep these pilots on property for a reduced pay amount, but at least they can get that back up and back into training get a lot quicker than go through the huge furlough process too. And that helped to mitigate that and greatly reduce a lot of the training costs too, because the FAA kind of spells out if you've been on a qualified airplane for so long, the different steps you got to go through to be qualified. So in some cases, people get qualified minimal, others they had to go through a short course, if it's a full school, but there's a cost associated with that. So that's where one of the preview questions you've been asking me about, I got my undergraduate economics, got an MBA too, and that's where I think it's good as union rep when you get negotiation time is to make the business case, because the bottom line, the business of business is business, and that's to make money. And the best job protection you can have is working for an airline that's making money and is profitable. And that's a good thing. You want that. And so that's where, again, we were able to cost out, if you really want to furlough X number of pilots, and that cost going backwards and then the cost going forward, where's that break-even point there too? And it's like, you really want to, wait that long, would you rather basically get back up and running a lot quicker than that too? And so we were able to make the business case there, and that helped mitigate the impact of possible. And we were able to get a good letter of agreement back in November of 2020, the day before Thanksgiving.
Nice. Well, going back to something you had said before too about, you know, it's hard sitting next to a pilot who's either offered a resignation or termination. Would be an example of the opposite of that, where a union rep really helped advocate for a pilot and potentially made like either a career saving move or helped them pivot and negotiate with the airline to really support that air crew member?
Well, yeah, my term just ended back in March. I'd been a rep for 6 years, so I actually had a few. This was the last year, 2 years, where a number of pilots were getting accused by fellow employees of certain, you know, actions that were inappropriate. And so the nice thing is, I mean, pretty much almost all of those, we were able to get those resolved and really get the tamped down also. I did have, I'd also, that was kind of getting of, I guess just working the system scheduling wise, and is, you know, looking at a potential suspension of, I think 30 to 60 days, something like that. And I said, hey, why don't you go back in the record and take a look for me? Let me know how many times you actually were able to help the company out and cover a trip on short notice, you know, like less than 2 hours, because I had lived right. And so he provided me with all that information. And I shared that with, the chief pilot. I go, hey, you know, we're sitting trying to hammer him because he stepped over the line here this one time. Okay. How about we look at all the times when, look at what he's done to be a company guy here and help the company out on short notice. So, you know, what do you think the repercussion is going to be if this guy gets hammered here and you suspend him without pay for 30 or 60 days? Do you think he's going to be apt to really, you know, be there with his bags packed, ready to go? And sometimes show up to the airport an hour after he's been notified by the company, you know, at all there too. And so that went well. And it not only did the pilot not get a suspension at all, it was pretty much just like a, you know, a letter of counseling. That was it. So that's just the minimal you could possibly get.
Yeah.
So that was kind of nice there. And that's where I think as the union rep, you got to do your homework. You have to anticipate the questions, and you got to do a deep dive and, you know, walk a pilot through, prepare them. And you know, if they've crossed the line a little bit there, then you know what? You better own it. Apologize. Not going to happen again. Move forward. Put it behind you.
So, well, I think you had mentioned earlier, too, the negotiation piece and just having to, or like I guess I was mentioning, working within creative constraints. And part of that negotiation is realizing it's not always A or B, but there's some third option that is maybe a win-win for both organizations. And you just have to think outside the box to get there. So, I think that's a great example of supporting a pilot as a union rep, where it's not just a case of termination, but the company won in having an employee that can regularly take short notice trips. And then that also impacts the customer satisfaction with, you know, not having canceled trips, and then also just the business impact of, you know, what are the economics of that flight not going out that he was able to step onto. Yeah. So
exactly. Yeah, that's huge. Exactly. That's true. Yeah. And that's the thing. It's that's where, of course, you're dealing with the negotiation will, or at least providing the pilot with a defense or explanation. But as far as the actual, you know, negotiation goes on with the company, as far as form of the contract goes, you know, as a rep, you're really not negotiating. What you're doing, giving direction to a separate negotiating committee that is the counterpart to everything. So I have not faced a negotiation with the company. We have a committee that does that, but they report back to us. We give them direction on where we want to go, what's acceptable, what's not, as far as the parameters looking at going from two. But again, like I mentioned, I'm really proud of being involved with everything that took place in 2021. You know, that was unprecedented for everybody. And you know, basically, you know, the company's making money for fist and all of a sudden not. And it's bleeding like crazy. So we came up with a side letter agreement March 13th, 2020, Friday. And that was exactly 4 weeks after we got record profit sharing a month prior on February 14th. And, you know, basically the company wanted to completely rebid April because our April schedule's running out, and they wanted the contract to be able to change a pilot schedule after they were already awarded it without any penalties. And so we're able to, you know, really short notice negotiation to hammer that thing out in less than a 24-hour period.
Wow.
And I remember as we were doing that, it was it wasn't a video conference call, it was all audio. The New York cap, the rep spoke up, said, hey, you know, if you're going to be possibly changing all these pilot schedules, you know, we got more people that commute than anywhere, you know, in the system go to New York because all the fly. And overall, most airlines get about 50% of the pilots that actually don't base, they actually, you know, commute. So for me, I live in Boise, so, you know, usually I've been based in Salt Lake most of my career. That's just barely an hour flight to get there, 5 hour drive. But, you know, you've got a fair amount of commuters. And New York was always the biggest one. And so anyway, the New York captain brought up and said, hey, you know, we're going to give the option to be able to change, you know, schedules after that. You know, these guys are, gals are bidding schedules that are commutable on both ends. Are you going to provide a hotel if you've changed their schedule and they're going to get a hotel either before or after the trip because you've changed your report time? And, you know, it's like, no, they weren't offering that. And that was enough to, boom, turn the light switch on and go back to 9/11. And of course, the schedule went almost to zero after 9/11. And so I remember after 9/11, when they started resuming flying, the flying schedule was just an absolute mess and just limited service too. And so Delta Time offered positive space commute to pilots and flight attendants to work if they needed it. And they did that for I don't know how many weeks or months they did. I don't remember. So anyway, I chimed in on the meeting and realized there were 19 voting reps at the time. Of the 19, only five of us were pre-merger with Northwest Delta guys around 9/11. And so I just said, hey, just want to bring to your attention here, there's a past precedent here too. And I said, I agree with the captain rep here from New York City as far as if we're going to allow the company to change schedules and, you know, that schedule to somebody needing a hotel room, not knowing what the status of hotel rooms are going to be there, then, you know, hey, let's have the company provide that. I said, likewise, here's what they did before. And I just said, we don't know where the bottom of this is. Okay. Have no idea. But I do know after 9/11, the schedules were an absolute mess. And so it was great being able to get to work. But yeah, I had to get a hotel room on my own several times before I could get home sometimes because the schedule was such a mess. And so we discussed that, and there's unanimous agreement. And so we gave unanimous agreement to ask the company for hotel rooms before or after rotation, and also pod space commuting before or after a trip if the pilot needed that, based on the company, you know, changing the schedule after it's been awarded. So we gave unanimous direction to the negotiating committee, and we put the meeting pause. They picked up the phone, called their company counterparts, and I think it was less than an hour. The company came back and agreed to that, and they also basically implemented for the flight attendants also and put out a memo the same time we got to that agreement. And so that was great to do that because, as it turned out, everybody's schedule was getting changed. So it worked out. It was system wide, and then that got you know, extended, I think, through into July. It went away for a few months, and then we get back into the next our final agreement during that time period, letter agreement 4/2004. And then we put in out of space community again, as long as the company was receiving the CARES also. And I got quite a bit of feedback from pilots in LA who said, Rick, this is the single greatest quality of life improvement I've seen in my career there, because for a lot of pilots that did not commute, that lived in base, because of the drawdown in the flying and the number of people that were a non-flying status for a while too, there were some pilots that were forced to commute to other bases too, because the company also retired some fleets. They retired the Boeing 777. They retired the MD-8 category the 717 category as well. And let's see, I think, the 747 is already gone. And then they drew down also some of the older 757s and 767s as well. So there, a lot of airframes were lost also along with the cutback of the flying. So that big domino effect going backwards that I'm talking about. So anyway, we were able to, like I said, kind of find a win-win there to, again, help the operation, because as the operation recovers, you know, and pilots can't get there, they can't get there. Okay, so,
right,
you know, this is kind of win-win. So anyway, and that happens also now, too, that the companies, they can see a big weather coming, they will be proactive and say, yeah, it's going to be a mess. So for pilots commuting to this base, we're going to authorize pilots base commuting to work there. Sometimes work also. And as we're speaking, another hurricane goes right now. And so we'll see what kind of impact that has as it gets closer and closer to the land. So, and I think the company sees the value in realizing, you know, because pilots, unlike flight attendants, pilots are qualified. Going to qualify only one airframe type, where the flight attendant qualify all the airframe types. So it really creates a challenge. And, you know, you just grab it, pilots who sit around the pilot lounge and say, here, go fly that airplane. You got to be
right.
That airplane.
Yeah. Well, it's been awesome. I appreciate getting to know what a union rep does. I mean, it's super educational for me. I got a couple easy, fun questions that we can conclude with here.
Okay.
But yeah, thank you for your time. And again, just to reiterate, neither of us are speaking on behalf of the DOD or the airlines, but our past experiences have certainly informed our conversation, and I've learned a lot. So this has been awesome.
Well, good.
Okay, some easy ones. What is your favorite airport to land at?
You know, that's kind of ebbs and flows with the season. And
that's true.
That time of year, too. I think one of the prettiest airports to go to is going to Geneva, Switzerland on a crystal clear blue winter day and just seeing the gorgeous snow-covered Alps going in there. You typically come in from the north, coming over the lake, land south, and that is just spectacular scenery doing that. And for the same thing, too, you know, taking off out of Milan, got the Alps up there as well, too. So this is a real pretty flying and scenery in some of those places. You know,
that's
domestically,
awesome.
It's also, you know, fun coming into New York and the New York skyline. And then, of course, coming to Washington, D.C., coming down the Potomac River, you know, landing on the 19. That's great. It's just gorgeous. Everything you can see there, you know, for the little bit of time you can see.
Right, fun. Yeah.
Now, so, yeah.
That's awesome. What is the worst airport to get stuck at?
I think that the worst place to get stuck at are the one where we have limited service coming in and out of those airports, because that means there's, you know, limited maintenance. You have to rely on contract maintenance. You don't have all the spare parts there. You know, it's one thing to have a mechanical issue. You're going to a hub airport. Well, the hub airport, they've got, you know, everything there. And so that's a challenge, especially, I think, at an international destination that it's really an international hub. You know, I just think to some smaller cities that we, you know, serve internationally and have a small or a seasonal presence, that's where it becomes a challenge logistically to get the plane fixed and, you know, get back on your way.
Well, that was a great business answer. I thought you were going to talk about the limited hotel or restaurant options related to an airport, but
well, you know, that's the thing. There's typically plenty of food to find. And when I do travel, I like to try something local because, you know, I can eat at plenty of chain restaurants back in the days. Mm-hmm. You know, I want to try something that's unique to the country, the city that as well, too. So, you know, it's kind of fun to go out of your...
Well, you're big into fitness and... routine is difficult on the road all the time. Do you have a favorite go-to snack where, you know, you can bring some supplemental nutrition on you without totally throwing your habits out the door?
Yeah. Well, what I typically do, we're not carrying liquids with us when we go through security in uniform. So I just, you know, left on a trip a few days ago and I packed a bunch of, you know, protein shakes that are already made up, you know, in my bag with me. And so I had some of those too. That's always good. And I'll grab some protein bars too. And beef jerky is good to have as well. So it is a challenge to learn how to eat well. And the nice thing, the company now gives us an option of choosing different types of meals. So I've been going with the gluten-free meal option, and that's actually worked out pretty nice. And, you know, lower fat content too also. But with me to international cities, depending on when you arrive, to make sure you're 24 hour liver, you're hitting the gym, getting a workout there too. And that really helps.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because every 6 months, you know, you got to pass the physical, and here you're getting plugged in for the EKG. And the biggest thing where audits don't pass the physical, you start packing on the weight because the weight adds to the high blood pressure. And nothing good transpires with blood pressure. And obviously type 2 diabetes becomes an issue. So it's a challenge. And as you get older, you know, you got to adjust what you can eat. And I can't pat down the big like I could in my 20s, 30s. So I avoid them. And, you know, want to be able to make it all the way to retirement age.
Yeah. Okay, last question. We talked a little bit about it as well, but is there still aircraft out there that would be a dream to fly, that military, civilian, commercial, general aviation, but something that you haven't flown yet that you would, given the chance, would love to take it out for a spin?
Yes. My dream airplane, the F-15. And part of that was when the F-15 was, of course, in production, late 70s, early 80s. So I served as a missionary for the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, St. Louis, Missouri. And my last area was just south of the St. Louis airport. And that was in 1982, at the height of production of F-15s. And, you know, you couldn't stand, you know, 3 feet away from a person, down with them. And those F-15s would take off at Lockhart Field and just stand on a tail doing a performance takeoff. And in and hearing, like, wow, love to fly that. So I've got a backseat ride in F-16. That was a great experience. I knew the F-16 could pull 9G. What surprised the heck out of me is how long the F-16 could sustain 9G. That was really something else. But yes, I would love to get a backseat ride in F-15 someday. Don't know if it will, you know, ever happen, but you know, hey, it's a good thing to have dreams. So we'll see you there. And as far as on the civilian side, you know, the warbirds, who would love to fly a bought F-42 Corsair, you know, that was the airplane in the Pacific for us. And of course, the P-51 Mustang also, too. And the Idaho Air Guard actually flew P-51 Mustangs, you know, years and years ago, too.
Oh, wow.
So that'd be fun one to fly as well. So anyhow,
yeah,
that's about it. But
it's been awesome, Rick. We've covered a lot of ground.
Well, thanks. Fun, and I appreciate, you know, you being so excited to take over the company and, you know, keep going there. And like I said, I love seeing what you're doing with the website and just the marketing, the social media stuff, because, you know, you're a lot more savvy on that stuff. You know, I'm a boomer, telling the boomer range there, and did a little more things old school, and you got great ideas and stuff as well too. So really thrilled to keep the business and family, and thrilled with what you're doing with everything too, and so excited to, like you mentioned earlier, way back when you graduated from Idaho State, getting a pin second lieutenant of Arizona too, and go from there, and those in the family, and then you pass them on to your brother, who is also serving in as well too, and that's great keeping those in the family. And of course, those second lieutenant bars were pinned onto Goldstone on a time too, so we get good mileage out of them there, and this excited for. Nothing that us retired military folks love is the next generation, you know, taking the torch. So thank you very much for the company, and thank you for your service to our country also with the Colorado Army.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks, Rick. We'll close it there. See you later.
You take care. Bye now.
Thanks for joining us on the Ultimate Aviators Podcast. Professionals use professional tools, and you can visit ultimateKneeBoard.com for your aviation needs. Additionally, visit harperaviation.com/gifts to find your special aviator something nice. Music was by The Fat Rat. Until next time, clear skies. All right. So as promised, end of the podcast, bit of an admin discussion. But yeah, due to tariffs and inflation and just the way the market's changing, we are no longer able to differentiate ourselves very well with our knee boards. We've always been made in America and proud of that. But it's just a different marketplace out there. And there are a lot of other solutions for flight products. And it's particularly shifting based off of iPad implementation. So while we do have iPad holders, I made the decision to close the business down. And I think ultimately it boiled down to we sell a commodity now, what was once novel when Rick started it over 30 years ago. There are a lot of other solutions out there, and we just can't compete on price, and a commodity is a race to the bottom in price. So I've learned a ton, and it's been awesome. And one of the cool things that has come from running this business has been starting the podcast as a way to get some unique conversations with professionals in the aviation industry. And so that's where I wanted some of your feedback. I've been interested in informative questions and interviewing styles for as long as I can remember. I remember interviewing my grandpa and just asking him random questions like, if you could have any other first name, what would it be? And throughout college, I started listening to podcasts and really liked the idea of podcasts. And I've learned from other professionals in the industry. And for a long time, I've wondered what would be a way for me to introduce the world to the professionals and friends that I have. I am able to associate with a lot of world-class people that are skilled at very different things. And so I've wondered what medium I could have to both interview my friends and get to know them better, but also share their cool stories and impact with those that might care about it. So I'd like your feedback. Please reach out. I've thought about ways that I could pivot the podcast so that it's not a total loss, but like a continues being a hobby project. So what that looks like, I still don't quite know. I've toyed around with a couple ideas, some names, just spitballing here, right? Nothing's definitive, but thought about Friends of Johnny. Like if I could have people from various backgrounds come on, it doesn't have to be aviation focused. I've thought about the Johnny Henderson Show, but that felt weird and too self-aggrandizing. I think the one that I keep coming back to is Leading Out Loud, a play on learning out loud, but, thinking out loud. I say learning out loud a lot on my blog because I like sharing ideas, and I think we're better for it with the cross-pollination and conflict, debating different ideas and things. So I liked the idea of leading out loud because leadership is something I've become a strong student of and supporter. But I also don't know if that pigeonholes me too much into just leadership, where I might want to explore things like fitness or systems or engineering. So anyway, I'd love your thoughts. I'd like to continue the podcast in some form or another, but what that looks like, I'm still uncertain of. So let me know what you think. And thanks for listening thus far. See ya.